From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Peoples of the world want peace. Whatever is necessary to bring about an avoidance of war and to bring about peace, this is what the peoples of the world want, and this is the message that we come to bring to Iraq as we have brought it to other places.
An African-American delegation of clergy is in Iraq. We'll have a report from Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad. Then we'll go to Ankara and talk with a peace activist about the Turkish parliament's resounding no to George Bush's desire for an invasion of Iraq. The U.S. government says they've brought Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to Afghanistan. We'll speak with Greg Palast.
Who's ringing in the cash? Who's ringing the cash registers in the war on terror? This is Greg Palast, BBC Television, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and I'll be chatting about this with Amy today.
And over 1,000 readings of the ancient Greek anti-war comedy Lysistrata were held in 59 countries and every state in the United States. We'll hear a portion of one of those readings. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration yesterday dismissed Iraq's destruction of six missiles as, quote, the mother of all distractions. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer said, here's the catch-22 that Saddam Hussein has put himself in. He denied he had these weapons, and then he destroys things he says he never had. If he lies about never having them, how can you trust him when he says he's destroyed them? But the Washington Post points out that it was Fleischer himself who may have been lying. The paper reports that Iraq never denied having the missiles. Their existence was outlined in Iraq's weapons declaration submitted to the UN Security Council in December. They were destroyed over the weekend in accordance with the UN. Iraqi officials say U.S. and British warplanes killed six and wounded 15 during bombing raids on Monday. Meanwhile, in Britain, opposition MPs charge the U.S. and British forces have drastically changed the mission of the so-called no-fly flights. Shadow Defense Secretary Bernard Jenkins said yesterday, quote, haven't we already seen the opening shots of the second Gulf War? The tactics are no longer just to enforce the no-fly zones themselves. The tactics now reflect the government's decision to help clear the way for the invasion of Iraq. U.S. and Turkish officials said yesterday a second vote in the Turkish parliament could take place as soon as next week on whether to allow U.S. troops to use Turkish bases for a second front against Iraq. And the Boston Globe reports this comes as U.S. planners prepare an alternative war strategy that could push back the start of a war until early April. Four North Korean fighter jets intercepted a U.S. Air Force spy plane in international airspace over the Sea of Japan early Sunday. It was the first time in more than 30 years that North Korean planes have threatened a U.S. aircraft. Alleged al-Qaeda leader Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has been moved from Pakistan following his arrest 4 days ago. He's believed to have been flown to a U.S. detention facility at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. The New York Times reports the CIA will likely use sleep deprivation and psychological manipulation to pry information out of him. If these tactics fail, Senator John Rockefeller of West Virginia suggests the U.S. might turn over Mohammed to a country that does not have restrictions against torture. Such countries include Egypt, Jordan, and Morocco. The Washington Post, in a report today, downplayed the recent revelation that the U.S. National Security Agency is spying on U.N. Security Council members. The Post headline reads, "Spying Report, No Shock to U.N." The Post article comes 2 days after the Observer of London broke the story, which has received little attention in the United States. In an exclusive report today, the Los Angeles Times reports the Pentagon is planning to assemble its own international spy network independent of the CIA. Critics warn the Pentagon is forming the spy force in order to collect intelligence that justifies future military missions. The FBI has acknowledged it has been secretly flying a high-tech spy plane to monitor residents of the city of Bloomington, Indiana, and neighboring communities in Indiana. The flights began over 2 weeks ago. two FBI agents told the Associated Press they are not aware of any threat to the region, but confirm the FBI is watching many foreign nationals who might have connections to, quote, terrorists. One local Muslim leader said the planes are targeting area mosques. The FBI said such surveillance is routine. An agent told a University of Indiana newspaper, quote, this one just happened to make the light of day because a plane flew too low. Bloomington is the home of Indiana University, where over 3,000 foreign students attend. In southern Philippines island of Mindanao, an explosion killed at least 19 people at a local airport. In an unusual move, the U.S. State Department has condemned Israel's increasing use of home demolitions and the rising number of civilians killed by Israeli troops. The U.S. has been seeking a period of quiet in the West Bank and Gaza as it tries to win support from Arab and Muslim countries for a war against Iraq. On Monday, Israeli forces killed 8 Palestinians, including a 13-year-old boy in the Baraj refugee camp. A 33-year-old pregnant woman was also killed when Israeli troops blew up her neighbor's house. Charlotte Beers, the former advertising executive who took charge of U.S. public diplomacy after the September 11th attacks, announced yesterday she is resigning from the State Department. Beers' main role was helping to reshape the negative world opinion about U.S., particularly in the Muslim world. Among her initiatives was the controversial Shared Values TV series that featured videotaped testimonials from U.S. Muslims about their positive experiences in the United States. Many Muslim countries refused to air the TV spot, citing it as state propaganda. At Yale University, thousands of janitors, secretaries, dining hall workers, and graduate teaching assistants went on strike today, beginning a 5-day strike. It's one of the broadest walkouts at any university. Reverend Jesse Jackson addressed a rally yesterday, noting that Yale has an $11 billion endowment. Reverend Jackson said, it's too rich for the workers to be so poor. And thousands of students at over 300 high schools and colleges have pledged their support for a 1-day student strike against war scheduled for tomorrow. And in related news, a high school student in Broomfield, Colorado, has been suspended for putting flyers about the anti-war walkout in the school. The Associated Press reports the student, David Dial, faces expulsion if any students walk out tomorrow at his school. You are listening to Democracy Now!
So, okay, it's 411 BC, a very bad year to be an Athenian. We've been at war with Sparta for 20 years. Nobody seems to remember who started it or why, and by now, nobody seems to care. We Athenians are definitely not winning, but then the Spartans don't seem to be winning either. At this point, basically the war is winning, and we'll keep on winning until I guess we either come to our senses or kill every last person in Greece. Oh, and as if that weren't enough, we had a plague, too, right here in Athens. The last sane politician we had, Pericles, died a while back, and since then it's been swindlers, monsters, and fools. One senator after another coming up with yet another crackpot scheme, and all the boys go nuts again, running off in all directions, and basically, we're at war with everybody. You'd think we'd have the sense the gods gave lettuce and just stay put. I mean, we Athenians are stinking rich. Tons of gold up in the Acropolis. But still, we want more. And every 2 minutes, somebody has the bright idea to charge off and invade someplace else. Well, you look on the bright side. We have done one thing. We've united the rest of Greece. Greeks can never agree about anything, right? But we've done the impossible. Everyone hates us. At least they agree about that. It took some doing, but this city has been run so badly for the last few years, we pissed everyone off. Spartans and Thracians are talking to each other for the first time in centuries. Of course, they're basically talking about what jerks we are, but still, it's an accomplishment.
Catherine Bloom, co-founder of the Lysistrata Project. Yesterday, over 1,000 readings of the ancient Greek anti-war comedy were held in 59 countries and in every state in the United States. We'll speak with her later in the program. First, as the U.S. and Britain continue to press for a new resolution on Iraq this week, many foreign embassies have withdrawn their personnel from Iraq ahead of an anticipated U.S. attack on the country. However, some embassies have kept their offices functioning as diplomacy and international international opposition to war continue. We go now to Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill reporting from Baghdad. He says some foreign embassies are not optimistic that war can be averted.
Some Western diplomats still in Baghdad are saying they believe that President George W. Bush will decide this weekend on an attack plan for Iraq. Some predict that heavy bombing could begin by the end of next week. If the report from Chief UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix at the UN Security Council on Friday indicates any material breach by Iraq, then the diplomats predict that war would come swiftly, perhaps even with UN Security Council backing. Even if the report at the Security Council paints a positive picture of Iraqi cooperation, the diplomats here in Baghdad say it's unlikely to effectively stop Washington's war plans, though it could delay military action for a few weeks. Already, the U.S. is escalating its attacks on Iraq in the so-called no-fly zones, particularly in the south of the country. Washington's war planes yesterday attacked areas in the southern port city of Basra. Baghdad says the raids killed 6 civilians and wounded a further 15 people. The Pentagon has been systematically targeting Iraq's limited defensive capabilities in recent weeks. In these regular bombings, the U.S. has moved away from attacking Iraqi radar facilities and has been bombing command centers and weapons Iraq is allowed to possess under current U.N. Security Council resolutions. In particular, Washington has been targeting Iraq's Ababil missiles and its Astros II ground rocket launchers. These are weapons which could be used against invading forces moving in from Kuwait. These bombings continue as Iraq says it's taking an extraordinary step to prove its intent to cooperate fully with the weapons inspectors. Baghdad continues its supervised destruction of its Samud missiles, as called for by Chief Inspector Hans Blix. Iraq disputed the UN charge that the missiles exceed the 150-kilometer range permitted by the UN Security Council resolutions, and charged that the demand that they be destroyed was politically motivated and intended to degrade Iraq's defensive capability even further. Still, the missiles are being destroyed, and Iraq says this shows the lengths to which it will go to demonstrate its desire for peace. But in recent days, Iraqi General Amir Saadi, a senior advisor to Saddam Hussein, has said that if Washington continues to flout the UN and move toward a unilateral attack on the country, Iraq will end the process of destroying the missiles, which would then be used against a U.S. attack. Iraq has not allowed the destruction of the Samud missiles to be filmed, saying the images would demoralize Iraqis ahead of a possible invasion. Meanwhile, a group of African-American religious and civil rights leaders has arrived in Baghdad for a 3-day fact-finding mission. The group is led by Reverend Herbert Daughtry and Walter Fontroy, a former congressman and advisor to Martin Luther King, Jr. The group has been touring schools, hospitals, and other civilian sites in Iraq. They say they plan to take their impressions back to the U.S. and call on their congregations to take action against a war on Iraq. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
This is Herb Daughtry, Reverend Daughtry here in Baghdad, with the multiracial interfaith delegation of religious leaders on a mission of peace, a prayer, pilgrimage for peace. We're here bearing the hopes and the fears of the peoples of the world. We have met with many of the Iraqi people. We visited school, hospital, and also the bombed shelter. We hope to have a meeting with government officials sometime before we depart, which is Thursday. We heard that there was a bombing yesterday. But keep in mind that the war has never ceased. The bombing has continued. I just recently learned that from 1991 up to the present, over 100 sorties have taken place. So we have met, before we departed, we met with the ambassador of Iraq. We met with representatives of the United Nations, representatives of the State Department, carrying the message of peace. The people want peace, so we will carry the same message when we meet with governmental officials. The peoples of the world want peace, that whatever is necessary to bring about an avoidance of war and to bring about peace, this is what the peoples of the world want, and this is the message that we come to bring to Iraq as we have brought it to other places, to other officials. So hopefully we hope we can achieve our objective and save the world. We shudder to think what will happen when war starts, or should it start. We do not believe it's going to be confined to Iraq, but probably it will spread to other places. We may be on the brink of seeing the end of civilization as we know it, and therefore we make a fervent appeal to President Saddam Hussein and President George Bush that do not bring this world to war. Find a way to peace. Thank you.
And that was Reverend Dr. Herbert Daughtry of the House of the Lord Pentecostal Church in Brooklyn, New York, speaking to us from Baghdad, Iraq. The Turkish parliament stunned Washington on Friday by voting against a resolution that would have allowed tens of thousands of U.S. troops to use the country as a base for an attack on Iraq. The U.S. was so sure of victory that the military had already begun unloading equipment at Turkish ports. 24 U.S. military vessels are still idling off the coast. But U.S. and Turkish officials said yesterday a second vote in the Turkish parliament could take place as soon as next week on whether to allow U.S. troops to use Turkish bases for a second front against Iraq. Yesterday, I talked to Turkish peace activist Müge Sökmen. I asked her what the role of the peace movement played in the Turkish vote.
First of all, that the peace movement did play a great role, because we all knew that 90%, over 90% of the Turkish population was against. But the demonstrations have been escalating. Ever since the 1st of December, it first started in the 1st of December, we had the first meeting, and then ever since there has been more and more meetings and demonstrations, and people have been sending mobile SMS messages to the parliamentarians, faxes, telephone calls. You know, there has been a great pressure on the parliament. So I do believe that the peace movement has really made a change and has really affected this decision, first of all, because this parliament was ready to hear, actually, what was being said. I think that's also very important, because I have personally visited the parliament in January with an international group of peace activists, and we were, and the head of the parliament, the spokesperson of the parliament, spoke with us, and the Deputy Prime Minister spoke with us, and both of them were saying that they themselves were against the war and that they would do everything they could to stop this war. And we told them that we took them seriously and that we did believe them, but of course you can never be sure with politicians. But they have just shown that they were sincere, which is, of course, something we've been celebrating ever since.
What about this discussion of a second vote that would take place after a special election on Sunday that could lead to the selection of a new prime minister, a pro-war, pro-U.S. Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan?
I believe that the second vote will be after Mr. Erdogan is elected. I do believe that they will wait for him to be elected. You know, Mr. Erdogan is now outside the parliament, and though he is the head of the party, he is not the prime minister, and he has to be, because of a problem he had with a speech he made some years ago, and now he's going to be elected again, and then he will be the prime minister. This is what we're expecting. And I do believe that it will be after that that a new voting will take place, first of all. And meanwhile, we have a very, very great pressure from the Turkish big media, because, you know, we have conglomerates who do have quite big stakes in Turkey being in the war. So they are really pressing the parliamentarians and the civilians and everybody. They keep saying that this was a big mistake. We will all suffer it very, very badly, because economically the economy will go bankrupt. You will, you know, the peace activists will repent. They will pay a big price for, you know, saying no to war, both the civilians and the parliamentarians. This is what the big media is now saying all the time. And this has really made the parliamentarians afraid, as far as I can see. They really did give a brave, brave decision, which it was really brave, and they are really being pressed now.
Why is the media doing this?
We have one owner for several big newspapers, and he is also said to own a petroleum what's the, one of the BP centers, the greatest one, which will be supplying oil for the American troops, let's say. Things like that. I mean, they do have, they do have an interest in having the war, in economical interest, I mean.
And what is Erdogan, who could, the head of the Justice Development Party, who could become prime minister, what is his position towards the United States?
He is pro-war. He has declared to be pro-war.
Why?
He thinks Turkey should not give the chance of controlling the region, as far as I can understand. He thinks that if we stay out of this war, we may lose control of the region, and also, of course, that we may suffer economically very much. So that's what I can understand, actually. He has been talking with the U.S. Committees, you know, and he has been telling them that he has advised the deputies to say yes to this in the parliament, but they didn't, actually.
It's quite something that they voted against the U.S. interests, given that Turkey receives, what, something like the third highest amount of U.S. foreign aid in the world behind Israel and Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is, but I think this money discussion was one of the reasons why people said no. People were really offended, and it was really, you know, seen as something humiliating that so much money was spoken of, that money was so much the issue, and that people felt like they were being bribed. And all the cartoons in the foreign press were circulated in the internet and in the press, in some of the press in Turkey. And so, you know, showing our prime minister like a belly dancer, letting some money be put in his, you know, outfit. So people were really furious. So I do believe that was one of the reasons. All this money talk was one of the reasons why some of the deputies felt very confident and very justified when saying no.
Müge Sökmen is with the Peace Initiative of Turkey, speaking to us from Ankara. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with a Kurdish activist in Washington, D.C. The noble sound of protest, all that and more. I'm Amy Goodman here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. The Washington Post is reporting today that Kurdish authorities are girding for a possible Turkish intervention in Iraq by deploying militiamen to key areas of northern Iraq and setting conditions for acceptance of any troops from Turkey in their region. Thousands demonstrated yesterday in the city of Erbil against the possible entrance of Turkish forces into their region. They carried signs with such slogans as Down with Turkey, Up with the United States. We're going to turn to Connie Shulam, director of the American Kurdish Information Network. Connie, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
As I try to get my voice back, can you talk about your concerns and the Kurdish people's concerns in northern Iraq?
We're very concerned. Turkey has been turned into a Trojan horse comes in with the intent of providing quote-unquote humanitarian aid, but with the real intention of really crushing the Kurdish experiment in self-rule. Turkey is not a model. Turkey is not a friendly force towards the Kurds in the region. However much U.S. Touts Turkey as a model for the Islamic countries in the world or in the region, that's the fear we have. We do not want Turkey in northern Iraq. In the past 12 years, thanks to some accidental policies of the U.S. government and the British government and the French government and the Dutch government initially that provided Operation Provide Comfort, that has now turned into Operation Northern Watch, that provides an umbrella, basically, protection to the Kurds. And in those 12 years, we have had our first taste of freedom, and that freedom we want to keep, we want to hold on to, and we want to not let it be crushed by the Turks. That's the intention of the Turks, no matter what they say. That's what they do. That's what they mean. And also, history is not looks at these things lightly. Turkey moved into northern Cyprus some 29 years ago, and they're still there. They haven't moved out. And chances are, with 80,000 troops moving in there, and then their appetite for the oil of Kirkuk and Mosul, which comes out between the lines in their own proclamations, and as well as the so-called their love of Turkmen minority, which up until last year they didn't even notice that we're there, but now they have said that they want to protect them with the real intention of really going for the oil that lies under the soil of Kirkuk and Mosul, two of the cities in northern Iraq.
Newsweek last week had an expose. They said Turkey's raising its price for allowing U.S. forces to invade Iraq from its territory. In early negotiations with the U.S., Ankara spoke of sending in Turkish troops to set up a buffer zone perhaps 15 miles deep along the Iraqi border. This would prevent a flood of Kurdish refugees from northern Iraq, the Turks said. But now Newsweek has learned Turkey's demanding it send 60 to 80,000 of its own troops into northern Iraq to establish, quote, strategic positions across a security arc as much as 140 to 170 miles deep in Iraq. That would take Turkish troops almost halfway to Baghdad. These troops would not be under U.S. command, according to Turkish sources, who say Turkey has agreed only to coordination between U.S. and Turkish forces. Ankara fears the Iraqi Kurds might use Saddam's fall to declare independence. Kurdish leaders have not yet been told of this new plan, but according to Kurdish spokesmen in Washington, who say the Kurds rejected even the earlier notion of a narrow buffer zone, Farhad Barzani, the U.S. representative of the main Kurdish party in Iraq, the KDP, says we have told them American troops will come as liberators, but Turkish troops will be seen as invaders. Now, this may be moot if Turkey voted down, the Turkish parliament voted down the U.S. request to use their country as a launching pad for the invasion, but there is going to be a second vote next week, it looks like, and there may be a new prime minister who is pro-U.S., pro-war.
What's my take on this?
Yes.
I see. I fear the same, basically, that the U.S. will move. I think U.S. is too much beholden to Turkey, and Turkey is too much beholden to U.S. through their 50-year friendship through NATO and U.S. Economical aid to Turkey as well as military aid, which nobody really doesn't seem to talk about it these days because everybody's talking about Iraq. 84% of Turkish arsenal originates from America, from these lands. So Turkey is not, even though there were some courageous parliamentarians who stood up and said no to war, but my hunch is next week they will give in, they will cave in. The other thing is, Turkey is going to move in, and they have already said that they also want to disarm the Kurdish militia, Kurdish army. We're talking about 110,000 Kurdish troops who in the past 12 years have, you know, been under the Kurdish generals, Kurdish chief of staffs, if you will. And that's the crux of the problem. You know, the Kurds have been abused in Turkey. Their language remains banned in Turkey. Their culture remains banned in Turkey. I mean, we're talking about the most basic elemental rights. We're talking about, like, Kurdish families cannot even name their children with Kurdish names. And that's the Turkey that's moving in. And can anybody really hope or expect that this mindset will, you know, protect the humanitarian or political rights of the Kurds? Absolutely not. We know them, and that's why there's this fear that, you know, Turks are even a greater menace now than Saddam Hussein, even though Saddam Hussein used chemical and biological weapons, and the Kurds have not, the Turks have not used them against us, but their oppression is real, and the fear that they will come is now it's like U.S. has basically sold us third time in a row, after in 1975 through Henry Kissinger, in 1991 through Senior Bush, and in year 2003 through Junior Bush. That's what we resent, and that's what that's what the protests are about. It should not happen. The media here should raise hell about this issue, but unfortunately, unless the voting is sustained, then it may be that our Turkish parliamentarians in Turkey will maybe saving us from the Turkish army, and I hope that happens, because U.S. government has already given the green lights to the government of Turkey to let the army move in there and do its so-called job.
Connie Shulam, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. He is with the Kurdish Information Network in Washington, D.C., director of the American Kurdish Information Network. You are listening to Democracy Now! Alleged al-Qaeda leader Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has been moved from Pakistan following his arrest 4 days ago. He's believed to have been flown to a U.S. detention facility at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. New York Times reports the CIA will likely use sleep deprivation and psychological manipulation to pry information out of him if these tactics fail. Senator John Rockefeller of West Virginia suggests the U.S. might turn Mohammed over to a country that does not have restrictions on torture. We're joined right now by Greg Palast. If you were listening on Friday to Democracy Now!, you may have heard his speech in Houston. Greg Palast is an investigative reporter with the BBC, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hey, Amy. I'm glad to be back. And now, this week I've released the U.S. edition. It's in paperback of my book. And it's like almost twice as big because I can print in the U.S., what was illegal in Britain, because I have there an Official Secrets Act. You know, you could go to the, you know, do hard time there for publishing this stuff. And I was very interested in the report on Khalid Mohammed. And in the midst of all this triumphalism, hey, we got the guy. It's kind of what I call the shirts and skins coverage. You know, we got him. I don't see U.S. reporters asking the question, like, how come we didn't got him before September 2001? This guy was in our hands several times. And we have to ask why that wasn't happening. And some of that is answered now in the new version of the U.S. version of the book, because I was able to follow up on the simple question of following the money.
Well, why don't you follow it for us here?
Okay.
Who is he, and how did the U.S. have him before?
Well, two things. There have been little buried in stories like the New York Times that we almost had him in Qatar, but the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia were not helping us catch this Saudi. You have to look at You have to always follow the money. And, you know, Khalid Mohammed did not put the September 11th hijackings on his credit card. You know, he had to get the money from somewhere. This is not a cheap operation, this type of multi-year operation. We go back in even the British version of the book, for which we got a Project Censored Award, BBC. We did discover that there was a meeting in June of 1996 in which Saudi billionaires and arms dealers met to determine how much they would kick into al-Qaeda, kind of a payoff to them to get them out of Saudi Arabia. That's a very serious meeting. This is where these guys got the money, because Osama ran out of money on goofy projects in the Sudan, so he needed new cash. So they funded these guys. And
who funded these?
Now, the Saudi billionaires and the arms dealers in the meetings. Now, I was going crazy, the BBC team, Guardian, who was in that meeting. And then we got to intelligence agencies in Europe.
And where was the meeting?
It was in Paris. Actually, it was in the, I can even tell you, the Hotel Mansour Royal in May, June 96, time of the Khobar Towers massacre, when a building was blown up then by al-Qaeda. 19 U.S. Servicemen were killed, crushed to death. And rather than grab the Saudis for funding these guys, we kind of gave them the wink and nod. There was no real follow-up on where their money was going. You have to follow the money to find out what they're going to do with it. You know, supposedly they were going to go run off to Afghanistan. We didn't mind if they were chopping off women's hands there, but you know, some of these guys ended up taking flying lessons in the U.S. with that money and, you know, with no intention of landing. Why weren't we following the money? And what I was going crazy about was who was in that meeting. And now two separate sources, including intelligence agencies and actually one of the arms dealers whose partners were in the meeting, has informed us that among the names are two names that really stuck out for me. One was a Sheikh Abdullah Baksh, according to this information. And that rang a bell because if you read the book, you'll find out Harkin Oil. Our president is a guy who made millions in the oil business without ever striking oil, but he kind of, you know, drilled into the pockets of some sheikhs. And every time his oil businesses in Texas were about to go under...
He was on the board of directors of Harkin.
Yes. Well, he had another company, Arbusto, then Spectrum. There was always some Gulf money coming in. And in the case of Harkin Oil, it was about to go under. It was refinanced through the largesse of Sheikh Abdullah Baksh. So, in other words, you have the same guy who, with not any intention of having funding an attack on the U.S., but nevertheless, money going to al-Qaeda, according to sources, also going into our saving our president's oil business. This, according to agents, creates a huge reluctance to follow the money. And under Clinton, there was always, by the way, it's not just one party. Under Clinton, there was a reluctance to go after the Saudis who sit on the oil spigots. But then under Bush, it really became very difficult. Agents said that they were shut down. We spoke to FBI agents, CIA, DIA agents. One of the problems is who was, so I was saying, why weren't we following up on the meeting? It seemed to be who was in the meeting. And also we also had in that meeting, apparently, according to the two sources, I wasn't in the meeting, but we're piecing it together, is a guy named Adnan Khashoggi, who was the bag man in Iran-Contra, the guy who provided the guns and the guns for hostages trade in Iran-Contra. And again, there's this very deep reluctance to go after these guys after not many people realize, and I have this in the American book, I couldn't put in the British hardbound version, is that after Poppy Bush left the White House, he went to work for Canadian Gold Mining Company, which is founded by Adnan Khashoggi. So Khashoggi had left by that time, but what's happening is that, as agents say, it's not a career maker to be suggesting investigations of your president or his daddy's business partners. So you have a problem in that part of the point of the Best Democracy Money Can Buy, the book, and now it's strengthened by the new information, is that you never know when foreign policy ends and the Bush bank accounts begin. It's a national discussion we need to have about what are the limits of uses of a presidential Rolodex. Who is funding them? Because we've been looking at campaign finance reform, but if you can rent our presidents or their sons or their daddies, that also has influence. It's not just campaign contributions. The Bush family is doing something different than other political families, which is that they're turning kind of politics into a profit center. And unfortunately, this seems to have created a blindness towards their financial and business partners and their political partners, so that it was very difficult to follow the money to Khalid Muhammad. I mean, now we're going after, so now we got the guy. Now we won't let anything stand in the way. But I just wish that some of the American newsmen would ask the same questions we're asking out of BBC and out of The Guardian and Observer, which I also write for, about, well, you know, he was within inches of our fingers for years, for the past 6 years.
Did the U.S. ever take him in at any point? Or
we got very close in 96 in Doha, and what happened was, Paul O'Neill, who was supposed to be in charge of the al-Qaeda investigation, then quit in absolute disgust with the Bush administration. John O'Neill quit in disgust. He was very upset about this business. He said we were being undercut and the administration was looking the other way. We could have gotten Khalid Muhammad before September 11th, and if we got him before September 11th, history would be quite different right now. And O'Neill was very upset, and he resigned and, of course, became head of security at the World Trade Center and went down with the building.
We're talking to BBC investigative reporter Greg Palast. You mentioned Iran-Contra and Adnan Khashoggi. Iran-Contra, the U.S., Reagan-Bush administration selling weapons to Iran, using the proceeds to illegally fund the Contras. John Poindexter was a part of that, which brings me to the second part of the question, to follow up on the speech that you gave that we played on Friday. John Poindexter, Total Information Awareness.
Total Information Awareness.
Now, you've uncovered scandal, fraud, corruption, and lies in the highest seats of power.
That's my job, yeah.
What about John Poindexter? You mentioned this in your speech, but what he was doing before he became head of the Total Information Awareness Program in the Pentagon.
Well, you know, this guy is a multiple felon. But he was let off the five felony convictions for aiding and abetting terrorism that came out of the Iran-Contra scandal. After his convictions were reversed, he went to work as senior vice president of a company called Syntec. And who has the big contracts for Total Information? There are three companies. There's Syntec, former vice president, John Poindexter, the head of Total Information Awareness. The second contract is went to Hicks and Company, and you have to understand that that Syntec got its contract from Poindexter's predecessor. He boosted it some more, but his predecessor was a guy named Brian Sharkey. Then Poindexter comes in and gives a new contract to Hicks and Company, whose company is that? Well, Brian Sharkey. Then the third one, and the really big one, as Forbes said, the real winner in the war on terror is a company called Choice Point. And that one should ring a bell for those who've heard me on Amy's show before. If you remember, I reported a story for BBC and The Guardian that 5 months before the election, there was a list of 57,000 voters who were removed, scrubbed from the Florida voter rolls, over half of them African Americans. This cost Al Gore minimum of 20,000 votes. By the way, Choice Point is the company that came up with this rotten racial list of people who were removed from the Florida voter rolls. By the way, they were all legal voters. They just happened to share a race and a name with some felon somewhere in America.
Now, at the time, it was Database Technologies.
Well, at the time, the Database Technologies is a wholly owned subsidiary of Choice Point. In addition, for example, Bode Technologies, which you have the DNA, if you look on if you watch like NBC Dateline, they tell you about this wonderful company that helps find little kitties who are lost by using DNA samples, and they encourage you to send in your DNA samples. Well, those guys are also the biggest providers. That's Bode Technologies, 100% owned subsidiary of Choice Point. And they provide the DNA samples to the FBI's new DNA database called CODIS. Now, the interesting thing, though, that's also a Choice Point company. They also do the airport profiling through another subsidiary.
Do you know that?
I don't know all the subsidiaries.
I ask that because in the last few days, there was a piece in the Houston Chronicle as I was flying through. I was at Bush Airport in Houston about Delta, just about to implement this program of color coding passengers. You've got green, where you can go through. The information they're getting, they're not naming the company, and I'm wondering if it's this one owned by Choice Point. They will code them according to database mining, your credit card, looking at your bank account.
That's
green,
our boys. Yeah,
you go. They're yellow, you're stopped, and red won't fly.
Well, you must be like flaming purple, Amy. The bells must go off completely. I have to say that Choice Point's been doing the profile. Also, the immigration intake points, they are handling that. So in other words, the guys who picked our president are now getting picked by our president to cash in on the war on terror. Now, by the way, I do want to give all your listeners a warning. Catherine Harris has written a screeching letter to Harper's Magazine saying that Greg Palast is twisted and maniacal. So I do want to warn you that, so you'll have to take, I guess, whatever I say with a grain of salt if you listen to Catherine.
Catherine Harris, the former Secretary of State of Florida.
Congresswoman Harris, the Honorable. And so Choice Point, by the way, this company did confess now to and this is not covered in any U.S. newspaper, but now you get on Democracy Now!, which is that Choice Point, this company, was sued by the NAACP. They went to Florida courts, and they said before the election they warned Catherine Harris's crew and the government that the list that they gave them was rotten, was filled with a bunch of black people who were innocent of any crime, but were still losing their civil rights. but they kept nice and silent and got several million dollars for that. And it was now turns out to be 97,000 people. And yet this is not covered in the press, but instead you get these wonderful, heartwarming stories about this wonderful company which is helping find lost kitties. And, you know, and by the way, they worked on identifying bodies from the World Trade Center. I guess, you know, everything is a profit opportunity, I suppose, you know.
Now, at the time of the election, did ChoicePoint own Database Technologies?
Yes, in the 2000 election.
Huh.
And they were the owners, and they constantly told me, they had no other, they only had the British reporters, as you mentioned, the Observer, with its report today. That's also my paper. That's a Sunday paper, The Guardian, where I had a column. And we were asking who these guys are and about the list, but you couldn't get any American reporters to ask about it. So you see, and so you see who's cashing in, and you always end up back at the election, because if you can take Florida, if you can reverse an election, then there is no limit. And now we have, unfortunately, one of the things you'll also see in the new book that I did want to warn people about, and you mentioned Martin Luther King III, who was here with me on your show on September 11th on the memorial service. After your broadcast, he and I spent quite a bit of time going over such things as the Martin Luther King Voting Reform Act of 2002, which, you know, he said his daddy is spinning in his grave knowing that his name is used for a plan which will actually Floridize the entire nation, take the Florida voting system of purges and, you know, hunting for the so-called fraudulent voter, roll that out nationwide. And so you actually have a program which is going to disenfranchise tens of thousands of black people nationwide under the name of Martin Luther King.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Greg Palas, for being with us. Eli Lilly also used ChoicePoint to purge employees for minor misdemeanor defenses post 9/11, citing security concerns.
Are you complaining? You know, that Dan Rather is on my show in Britain, another reporter is talking to him, and he said, you know, we'd love to ask questions like basically you do on BBC, but if I asked those questions, I would be lynched. I would be necklaced. A burning tire would be put around my neck as unpatriotic. So you're asking, you know, but I actually, Dan never explained when asking questions became unpatriotic. But so I'm glad you're here, Amy, to ask some questions.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you for asking the questions. Greg Palas, his book is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. It has just been released in the American edition. Greg Palas, BBC investigative reporter. We'll be back in a minute. Are listening to Democracy Now! Democracy Now! The exception to the rulers. Yesterday, over 1,000 readings of the ancient Greek anti-war comedy Lysistrata were held in 59 countries and every state in the U.S. as a way for actors the world over to register their opposition to a war in Iraq. Conceived just 6 weeks ago by New York actors Catherine Bloom and Sharon Bauer, the global theatrical anti-war protest is raising money for humanitarian aid groups working in the Middle East. There were events in Russia, China in the jungle, in Hawaii, in Athens, and in Iceland, at homemakers' reading groups in the Midwest, on sidewalks, subway platforms, parks and theaters, high schools, churches, and bars. Lysistrata tells a story of women from opposing states who unite to end a war by refusing to sleep with their men until they agree to lay down their swords. Powerless in their society, with too many of their sons and husbands being slaughtered in battle, the women take the only tactic available to them, a sex strike. Fast forward 2,400 years, swords are now weapons of mass destruction. Faced with the prospect of massive loss of human life, both Iraqi and American, Lysistrata Project participants worldwide took this new tactic and their voices to the mounting clamor of global anti-war protests. Lysistrata Project co-founder Catherine Bloom is in the studio with us. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Just in New York alone, there were over 60 performances.
Yeah. In spite of the very cold weather, people went to public places like Columbus Circle and Union Square. They were on the subways. They were in Grand Central Station. They were in little theaters all over the city. They were in bars and bookstores. And ultimately, we had a huge reading last night at BAM.
And what about other countries and other places in the United States?
Oh, it's been tremendous. And, you know, the thing is, it's expanded far beyond the realm of just actors. There are all kinds of ordinary citizens, civilians as we call them, who were just interested in being involved and thought that this was a really fun way to do it. So we had people in all 50 states, over 700 readings in the United States, and 59 countries, including Damascus, Syria, and Argentina, and Northern Iraq.
In Northern Iraq?
Yeah.
You talk a little more about this play? Who performed it in Northern Iraq?
A secret group of people from the International Press Corps who won't reveal their names because they're afraid they'll get fired.
Talk more about the play and how you decided on Lysistrata.
Well, I had been working on a screenplay that was a modern adaptation of Lysistrata when I heard about a group in New York called THAW, Theaters Against War, and they were planning an early March day of action, and I thought, well, why not do a reading of Lysistrata? The funny thing is people get distracted by the sex strike aspect of the play, and they think that that's what we're advocating, which is not the case at all. What we're really inspired by is the fact that here's a group of women who are facing a really destructive situation in their country, and they come up with a creative, nonviolent solution to achieve their goals of ending the war. And that's what we're trying to model, is a creative, nonviolent solution. And doing readings of this play is our way of doing that. It was also very important to us to let the rest of the world know that the Bush administration wasn't speaking for all Americans.
There is very little coverage of anti-war voices in the press. What kind of coverage did the Lysistrata Project get?
It's been stunning. In fact, there's a front section article in the New York Times today. We've been on CNN. The AP released a huge story which went all over the place. We've been in small town newspapers and radio stations, and there's going to be a big piece by Margot Adler this afternoon on All Things Considered. In fact, I'm going to be on another show on All Things and National Public Radio this morning later. So the coverage has been pretty huge.
Want to perform a little more Lysistrata?
The woman who directed our production last night, Ellen McLaughlin, wrote her own version. And this is Lysistrata's first speech. I hate women. Everything men say about us is true. Women are late to everything. Sometimes they don't even show up. Totally unreliable. Impossible. Where is everyone? This is just so embarrassing. Here I call a meeting of all women from every quarter of Greece, pan-Hellenic women's conference to discuss the most important issues of the day. And who shows up? Nobody. It's pathetic. I should have nailed up signs saying, "Women only, meet the goddess of love, in person, learn her secrets, Aphrodite tells all." The streets would have been so packed with shrieking women you wouldn't have been able to move. Or maybe I should have said, "Ladies' night to howl. Bacchanal babes wanted. Men need not apply. Drinking starts at noon and goes till you can't remember your name." By now, the timbrels alone would have been deafening. Every woman from Syracuse to Thrace would have been cruising this avenue looking for the wineskins. But you put out an all-points bulletin from one side of Greece to the other saying, "Women of Greece, it is the dawning of a new age. This is your moment. The salvation of the country lies in your hands. Come one, come all, from every corner of our land in solidarity and support on this historic occasion." And what do I get? Zip. Not even a stray hen. That's political consciousness for you.
Catherine Bloom, I want to thank you for joining us. And women around the world came out for this one, that's for sure.
Women
as well
and
as men.
Men, yes, absolutely.
If people want to find more out about the Lysistrata Project, where can they go?
They can go to our website, which is lysistrataproject.com.
And are you having more readings?
Well, people have been writing in saying, we didn't get one together in time. Can we do one now? And we've been saying, absolutely. There could be rolling Lysistratas from, you know, now till the cows come home.
Well, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
As we go to another protest today in San Francisco, the anti-war group Direct Action to Stop the War is planning to call for the shutdown of financial districts and other nonviolent direct actions in the event of a U.S. attack on Iraq. Joining them will be a most unusual anti-war protester, Warren Langley, the former president of the Pacific Stock Exchange. He is now working with Direct Action to Stop the War, a group organizing civil disobedience on the first business day after a U.S. attack. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you explain why you are opposed to war and why you are going to engage in direct action?
Well, I went to my first protest march on January 18th here in San Francisco on my 60th birthday. I looked around and saw a lot of people who looked like me. They had come in from the East Bay. They had come in from Marin, and they just wanted to be there and make themselves heard. And I thought, can I do something more? And since I have had a very establishment background, I grew up in the South. My dad was a World War II POW. I graduated from the Air Force Academy and spent 15 years in the Air Force. And I retired as a lieutenant colonel from the reserve. So I'm not your sort of traditional hippie protester. And I thought, well, maybe if I'm willing to go a little bit further, go a step further, other people who are out there talking and listening and thinking will do the same thing. So that's what made me look for somebody who was willing to go the next step, willing to take a risk.
And why are you now willing to be arrested, closing down San Francisco's financial district?
Well, I think I looked back over my lifetime, and I don't think things would have happened differently during the civil rights era in the 60s or during the Vietnam War era in the 60s and 70s if people hadn't been willing to take a risk. And I thought, I believe a lot in this country, and I believe in a lot of democracy, and so I'm willing to take a risk, and that's why I decided to join this group who are willing to civilly disobey and peacefully protest the war in ways that will get noticed. Hopefully, Mr. Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Powell will see these things happening and find some other alternative other than starting a war.
Warren Langley, why are you opposed to war?
I'm not opposed to war. I believe in a strong military. I've been involved in the military most of my life. But I think there's a time when you need to take military action, and the time isn't now for this kind of military action. I think disarmament's a valid goal and a critical outcome of what we're trying to do. I believe that there are ways to do it other than invading Iraq. I also think that regional destabilization and regime change are not something that we should be trying to do. I think democracy doesn't follow a unilateral conquest, which we're about to embark on. So that's why I think something else needs to be done.
Well, Warren Langley, I want to thank you for being with us in San Francisco, holding a news conference later today. U.S. Air Force vet and former president of the Pacific Stock Exchange. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera. Mike DiFilippo is our engineer. Our website, www.democracynow.org. Our email address, mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.